Well, there's a lot of ritual that goes in. And so we thought tonight we would do the full ritualized talk. And actually, in the tradition, the talk is a ritual. And it's not informative. So if you don't learn anything from what I say, don't be dismayed. Because the idea is not necessarily to be informative, but in a way to enact the feeling, the flavor of the Buddha's words, the Buddha's teaching. And so that's why traditionally every talk begins with an incense offering and full prostrations, which we didn't do because there wasn't enough room. And then this chant that we just chanted, and then the chant also at the end. So, I just thought I would explain that if you didn't already know that. So, I don't know. Do a talk on a Zen subject. A monk asked Huizong, "Do insentient beings understand Dharma when it's spoken?" Huizong said, "Insentient beings always speak Dharma. Their speaking never stops." The monk said, "Why don't I hear this?" Huizong said, "You don't hear it, but that doesn't mean others don't." So the monk said, "Tell me then, who hears it?" And Huizong said, "All the sages hear it." And then the monk said, "Do you hear it?" And Huizong said, "No, I don't hear it." And the monk said, "If you don't hear it, how do you know insentient beings understand the Dharma?" Huizong said, "This fortunate person doesn't hear it. If I did, I would be equal to all the sages. And then you could not hear me expound the Dharma." The monk said, "If so, human beings would be left out." Huizong said, "But I speak to humans, not sages." The monk said, "What happens to sentient beings after they hear you?" Huizong said, "They are no longer sentient beings." So that rather lengthy conversation is our subject for tonight. So I've been interested lately in different Zen stories that have to do with insentient beings hearing or not hearing the Dharma. And they're all kind of like this. And when you hear these stories, you wonder, you know, what is the intention behind these stories? What are they trying to do? Is it a joke somehow? Is it trying to tell us something that is somehow sensible or valuable for us? Is it just a strategy to confuse us so that we stop our usual chatter and think more deeply about what's going on? Well, so it's about sentient beings and insentient beings, and so what is a sentient being, after all? What is sentience? Well, to be sentient is to have the power of sensual perception, to be conscious, to perceive, and to be aware that you are perceiving. That's actually the definition of sentience. So, given that definition, we would usually consider animals, including human beings, to be sentient, and plants and
rocks and tiles and roof pebbles and stones and nails and things like that to be not sentient. When a being is sentient, there is a degree of mobility and choice, because when there's mobility, it's like, now where do I go? You have to choose. So sentience has that feature. And at a certain level of complexity, sentience becomes sentient of its own sentience. And then there's perception of a self, self-awareness or self-consciousness. And pretty soon, there's language and being human and all the special joys and sorrows that go along with that particular condition. So, but that's, we know that. So why is this story evoking all that? Well, sentience is, you know, consciousness, which goes with perception. But then you have to ask, well, what is perception? What really goes on in the process of perception? You hear something, a bird, the wind. But if you really investigate deeply what you're hearing, the closer you get to hearing, the more doubtful it becomes. What are you really hearing? Where is the sound actually coming from? The deeper you investigate this with the mind of meditation practice, the more it becomes clear that there actually isn't anything to hear. That hearing is a kind of deep perceptual illusion. And it's the same with the other senses too. It's not that nothing's happening when you perceive. It's just that the closer you get to perception, the less clear it is what's actually happening. And you realize that probably what you are experiencing is the activation of your own mind, which I think now is sort of a scientific fact. People who examine cognition say that that's actually the case, that what really goes on is you're perceiving the activity of your own brain. Which means that when you hear something, you are what you are hearing. It's true. And what you are hearing is yourself. It's actually the case that you are the object of perception, and the object of perception is you. And if you investigate this closely enough, you'll have that experience. And you'll realize that when you perceive others and take in others deeply through your perceptual organs, and thought is also a perceptual organ, you have a thought about others and so on, it's actually yourself that you are apprehending. You are others, and others are yourself. The world you live in is yourself, and you are that world. So I'm serious. You know, this is not some trick of logic or, you know, brilliant scientific tidbits. This is actually our lives. If you quiet your mind and investigate your acts of perception closely, you will see exactly what I'm talking about. So, Buddha was a human being, and he gave teachings for himself and for his own human predicament. and also for us, because we're in the same predicament. But also, he saw that if being human is the problem, then the solution to the problem is to go beyond being human. And this is a part of being human. If you're human, you can go beyond being human. You can release yourself from the trap of being human. Actually, the most true thing that we could say about being human is that human beings are beyond human beings. In Buddhism, there's a traditional teaching of the six realms. The God realm, the fighting demon realm, the animal realm, the human realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realm. And these are the six realms through which beings transmigrate. I'm not sure where plants and rocks and things fit into this six realms, that maybe they don't fit in. Maybe this is only for sentient beings. Anyway, all the six realms are contained in the human realm. And maybe you can appreciate this. Maybe you have had the experience of being an animal, you know, living in a kind of fog, motivated only by your desires and appetites. Or, to put it a more positive spin to it, just enjoying your sensual life and nothing more. Sometimes you're a fighting demon, overcome by anger and passion, blind with rage. Sometimes you're a god, delighting in refined aesthetic and intellectual pleasures, almost as if you didn't have a body. Sometimes, and I hope not too often, you're a hell dweller, blind with despair or confusion. Sometimes a hungry ghost, raging with unfulfilled desire. All of this is our human experience. We all know about this. And all of it is a part of being human. And so is going beyond all this to freedom and peace, which is going beyond being human. Going beyond the six realms means including the six realms as Dharma, not anymore being caught by them, being subjugated by them, but being able to transport oneself in them as Dharma with a loving heart. Of course, that makes the six realms completely different. They say that there's a bodhisattva in each of the six realms, and you become that bodhisattva. You see all of these realms, and you experience all of them, but you don't take it personally. You do it in solidarity with others and on behalf of others, which of course makes it completely different. I think that we all come to practice wanting something, some relief, some peace, some truth, anyway, something beneficial for our lives that don't seem to be in our lives now, which is why we come seeking something. So we come out of need, or out of suffering, or out of desire of some sort. But if you keep on with the practice, little by little, you see that the practice actually is not about your personal human need. That it goes beyond this. And in that way, your need is satisfied, not by being satisfied, but by realizing that you have to go beyond it. So in a way, you know, practice does not solve our human problems. what it does is it shifts the ground of the problems so that, in a way, even though they're still there, they disappear. They don't appear as problems anymore. They just appear as human functioning. So we don't have the problems we came with. We didn't solve them, we just don't have them anymore. Now we have a whole new set of problems. Like, who's going to take care of the Zendo? And how am I going to get free to go to Sesshin? And how am I going to love all the people I'm having a hard time with? And how am I going to take responsibility for this whole world and save all sentient beings and end all confusion and completely become the Buddha way, like the vows say? So these are real problems, big problems. So you're not without problems, but you just have different problems. So now I sometimes devise wise Zen sayings, profound and wise Zen sayings, and this is my job to share wise Zen sayings with people, so I have a new one for you today. So here it is. Time is passing. This is a profound truth. And it's a universal truth. It's true not only for Buddhists. It's true for all sentient beings and all insentient beings. Time is passing for everything that exists. Have you noticed that there are no breaks in time? You think, like we just said, let's take a break, but we weren't taking a break. We were simply changing the activity that we were doing as time was passing. Time was not taking a break. Time was going on. Time was going on for us, and time is going on for tiles and walls and pebbles and wooden floors and ceilings and doorknobs. What does this mean, time is passing? It means that every moment is dying to itself. Just like you can't catch hearing or seeing, you can't catch time. As soon as a moment arises, it passes away. There is no discernible duration. Arising and passing away are simultaneous. That's why there's no such thing as seeing or hearing. That's why the closer you get to seeing and hearing, the more you understand seeing and hearing, and the more you understand that time is passing, the more you realize there is nothing to grasp that can be the seen or the heard. And that's why we are sentient beings, and also we are insentient beings. And I think we know this, because it is literally built into our bodies and our emotions. On the one hand, we're all born, and we all live for a certain amount of time, and then we die. This occurs to me is the shortest novel ever written. She was born, she lived, she did something, something was done to her, she knew some people, they knew her, maybe. She died. That's the shortest novel. And that's our life. But on the other hand, if you look at it from another angle, we aren't really born and we don't really die. The only thing that's going on here is elements are rearranged. and they're always rearranged. There's no end to this. Life and death flows on. That's real. And that is the Dharma. That is basically what the Buddha taught. So, this is something that can be investigated very directly in your practice. When you sit down, maybe even now, while you're sitting here listening to my words, feel how gravity is holding your body to earth. This is an actual experience. We say, I weigh so many pounds, but that's not really the case. That's just an index of how much gravity is holding you to earth, with what kind of force. And when you sit down, and there's nothing else to do, you can actually feel that. And you can trust gravity. It is so reliable. You can trust your body in that way. And the earth is our body. This is the case. The earth is our body, and you could feel one's own body. You could feel your own body as earth. And earth is insentient. And your body also is literally insentient, just the way the earth is insentient. But also, of course, our body is sentient, because there's a breath. If there weren't a breath, your body would be an insentient being, like a stone. But there's a breath. The breath is spirit. The breath is consciousness. So when you sit, you can feel your body as earth, and you can feel your breath as awakening, as consciousness. Without this breath, the body is prone on the ground and stays there long enough, it returns exactly to the earth. Its elements break up and become the earth once again. And that's what your body came from. But as long as you have breath, as long as you have consciousness, your body is held up in this dignified human posture that we take when we sit in meditation. It's a kind of archetypal posture of a human being who's conscious and alive. And all this you can feel quite directly in your sitting practice. You can feel the earthiness of your body, and you can feel how consciousness illuminates your body. You can be present with this. And you can allow this aspect of your life to come forward, training your heart in it each and every period of meditation, your whole life through, until that side of your life becomes strong and carries you forward into every moment of time. Do insentient beings understand the Dharma? They are beyond understanding. They speak the Dharma ceaselessly without ever stopping. This means time is passing. Why can't I hear their speaking? I do hear it. Also, I don't. This means I live it. I live their teachings because I also am these teachings, and my life expresses them. They are the process of my body, of my perception, of the unfolding of my human consciousness. But also, wrapped up in my human problems and my human concerns, I forget this all the time. So, like the rest of us, I'm swimming around in the lake saying, you know, I'm thirsty, where's the water? Who hears these teachings? Sages hear them. That part of ourselves that knows who we are. But the trouble with sages is that they know this and they speak this, but we cannot understand them because they're so far beyond our human problems that it's like they're speaking Greek and we just don't get it. We cannot understand what they're saying. And we don't realize that we don't really need to understand. So we keep trying to understand and we keep being frustrated. And this is sad, difficult, and also beautiful. It's funny, you know, now I have achieved an advanced enough age to have spent so many years wearing Buddha's robe and repeating Buddha's words that people now think I know something what I'm talking about. Just time goes by, you know, and people get this impression. He looks old, he must know what he's talking about. This is definitely not the case. I am as confused and clueless as the next person. And maybe the only difference is that most of the time I don't mind that much. And yet, people listen to me and they take me more seriously than they should. Because you already know the teaching of the ascension. You already have everything you need. You don't need to listen to me. You don't need any improvement. When people come and listen to me, they already know what it is they want to hear from me. Whatever I say to you that makes sense to you and seems useful is exactly because you already know it in your inmost heart. So it sounds right. So sages cannot teach us when we are human. Only human beings can teach us. Because the only ones that we can hear are human beings. So to me, this is like the supreme greatness of the Dharma. It's basically a stupid human teaching for stupid human beings, spoken by other stupid human beings, all of whom are also at the same time Buddhas, beyond everything, beyond life and death, beyond being human, only they don't know it, and so they have to do extreme things like struggle with meditation for years on end. And even go so far as to put on robes and offer incense and shave their heads and bow so that they can understand their lives completely by finally giving up hope of understanding anything. Now, this is a ridiculous proposition, but I think this is what goes on. Dogen says, speaking Dharma by means of speaking Dharma actualizes the fundamental point about Buddha ancestors and trusting to Buddha ancestors. This speaking Dharma is spoken by Dharma. Speaking Dharma is neither sentient nor insentient. It is neither creating nor not creating. It is not caused by creating or not creating. It doesn't depend on conditions. This being so, just as birds fly in the air, speaking Dharma leaves no trace. It is just given to Buddhist practitioners. And it's a lovely gift. So we have to investigate these things seriously. On the one hand, everything is fine and there's nothing we need to do. But on the other hand, as long as we're here in this life, what else is there to do but deepen our appreciation of what's true about our lives? So we come to sit. And we investigate our lives. Mostly, sitting is about our body. Feeling gravity. Feeling breath. Feeling consciousness illuminating and lifting up our body and our life. So investigate this, and investigate seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and touching. These are our practice. And investigate the mind and the heart. Investigate thoughts and feelings as they arise and pass away. What's happening? What are you feeling? What are you thinking? Where does it come from? Where is it going? How are you a sentient being? And how are you an insentient being? How is it that there's no hearing in hearing and no seeing in seeing? Can you see the darkness in the light and the light in the darkness? It's there, if you look. But you have to step back into your looking, beyond the grabbiness of your eyes. So this is not a matter of extra outward effort, which is the kind of effort we've been making all of our lives to learn. Everything we know is an outward effort, a grasping effort. And that's appropriate for those things we've had to learn. But this is not that kind of learning. This is a stepping back into our lives. A settling of the heart so that our life can come forward and we can really feel it. Dogen asks, what happens at the precise moment when sentient beings hear the Dharma expounded? What happens? This is what we have to investigate. And there's no end to this investigation. And it's the joy of a human lifetime, the deepest possible joy. So I'll close with a poem. A thousand people crowded within a lit square. Three trees silhouetted, straight up, branching eerily out. Ordinary clouds stream against the fluted airways. How their smoky fingers make music against the dark. Quietly, what's good descends like dust or dusk onto the milky landscapes. The people stand still, and all around them, the bluster of their thinking pulls down lightning from above, and the platforms rattle. The owls in the trees scatter their nocturnal alarms. How decisive the universal defeat. So that's my ritual, formal Zen talk. Now it's over. And now we're going to, continuing with this theme of ritual, I hope you're enjoying this ritual. We're going to have another ritual. We'll have a opening the eye ceremony and dedication of the temple ceremony. And I'll explain to you what we're going to do. This is not exactly how you do this ritual, but we've adapted it to the conditions. It's more or less the major elements. So the first thing that happens in a ritual like this is that the officiating priest makes a formal Dharma statement, sort of setting the intention for the ritual. And then in this particular ritual, we are going to open the eye of this Kanon statue, empowering the statue to shed Buddha light on everybody who comes into this room. So we'll take a brush and we'll make a mudra and say some words which will empower the statue. The statue, having been empowered, now she's hungry. So we'll feed her, give her some food, which will purify with incense, and then we'll feed Kanon. After we feed her, we'll offer a stick of incense, and that'll be the signal to begin. Roll down on the bells, and then there'll be, ordinarily there would be three prostrations, but well, actually maybe I could do the three prostrations. If we move these two cushions out of the way, there'll be enough room. So I'll do three prostrations, and then I'll come up and offer another pinch of powdered incense. We have some charcoal to put in there, right? I'll offer another piece of powder, and a chip of powder and incense, and then we'll chant the Enme Juku Kanan Gyo, which is a sutra of Avalokiteshvara. We'll chant that. It's very brief. I think you have it on your sheets there. We'll chant it. It's traditionally chanted seven times, at least in our tradition. That's our tradition. And then when the chanting is finished, we'll sort of pause for a moment and take this in. And then after that, Russ and Joe, who are our resident priests here, are going to say something. And then after that's over, I'll invite any one of you who would like to just say words, to say some words. And when everybody's finished talking, we'll chant a formal dedication for the ceremony, and then we'll chant the universal dedication. Do you know this one? All Buddhas, 10 directions, 3... That's a universal dedication, like all purpose. You can't go wrong when you dedicate things to Buddha, all Buddhas in 10 directions, and so on. You always know you're covering the bases. So whatever else you dedicate to, you always also dedicate to all Buddhas, 10 directions throughout space and time, and so on. So we'll conclude with that, and then we'll be finished. Now, here's the thing. A lot of people complain about ritual. Maybe some of you are thinking, like, oh, geez, you know, I did not attend all this. But you know, you have to appreciate, like we like to go to the theater and the movies. Where do you think that comes from? It comes from religion. Originally, the enactment of some religious realm in the ordinary world of space and time was part of every religious tradition that ever existed. And so that's where all theater comes from, and all ritual comes from that. All theater comes from religious ritual, and the movies come from the theater, right? So when you go to the movies, it's a religion. So this is, just think of this like going to the movies. When you go to the movies, you are perfectly willing to suspend your disbelief, right? You don't say, like, wait a minute, like, that character couldn't be doing that. You take it for granted that the characters are doing what they're doing on the screen, and you enjoy it, you know, afterward you might say, lousy movie. But while you're there, you give yourself to the movie, right? Well, the ritual is the same way. You have to project yourself into the ritual. And you do that the same way you do it in the movies. It's an act of imagination, right? So I do a lot of rituals, and I always take them very seriously, and I give my whole heart in that moment to the ritual, and I really think that I'm doing it fully. And it's actually the space, and maybe we'll experience this, the space of ritual is a powerful human space to be in. It does something into the heart, you know, it sort of answers some request of the heart for a world in which other things are possible than the one we usually live in. So I'm saying that it's a very important part of the ritual is how you conduct yourself in the ritual in terms of your how you situate your heart and your intention. So whatever you can do, do your best to just be present. This is the same way you're present on your cushion, with your body, with your breathing, and really being there. If your mind wanders, you know, bringing it back, just like when you're sitting, and really trying to be present for the words that are said, the gestures that are made, and the kind of conceptual framework of the ritual. So that's the idea. I thought it would be good if I explained, right? I just didn't do this and mumbo jumbo stuff. Okay. All right. So I think if we just move these two cushions, they'll be able to press them. It'll be much better.